From NPR News, you're listening to the best of Weekends and All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz, the host of the program on Saturday and Sunday. This episode, Medicare's math problem, why the numbers just don't add up. Also, one former Army colonel's plan to slash the Pentagon's budget by half. Also, how Everybody Loves Raymond got lost in translation on the way to Moscow. And the good times are rolling, my friends. The Cars have a new record. And Rick Ocasek, it's not Ocasek, we've all been saying it wrong, he will stop by. That's all on this episode of Weekends and All Things Considered.
I-17.
Every week, 78-year-old Milton Jones calls bingo at his local senior center in Pittsburgh.
G-51.
For 31 years, Milton worked in Pittsburgh steel mills.
From 18 years old, I worked in the open hearth. And when we made the steel, and I worked in a lower level where we poured the steel.
Now, like most folks over the age of 65, Milton depends on Medicare. And like most Medicare beneficiaries, he believes he's simply getting what he paid for.
Do I feel like I earned it? I imagine so. I paid taxes all my life.
From NPR News, this is Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz. And our cover story today, Medicare's math problem. Now, the word entitlement, at least in a legal sense, means something very simple. It means a right granted to you. That's Medicare. In Washington speak, it's called an entitlement program, meaning that you and me and every single American is entitled to receive guaranteed health care once we turn 65. It's our right. And most of us believe it's simply a return on a lifetime of paying for it from our weekly or monthly paychecks. That's basically what the government has led us to believe.
I've paid taxes all my life.
But the numbers just don't add up. A few chairs away from Milton Jones in that same Pittsburgh Senior Center, 70-year-old John Fury is also playing bingo. For 30 years, he delivered the mail, maybe even yours.
I walked about 7 miles a day, about 1,200 steps every day.
And every week, like every single other American, a modest chunk of his wages was taken out. The Medicare tax.
It was on my pay receipt.
He's a Medicare beneficiary now, and like Milton, he told us he'd paid up over his career.
That's a good bingo.
Same with Diane Rosolofsky. She's a retired librarian from Seattle.
Oh, yes. Well, I had been paying into the Medicare system since 1966.
Every paycheck of her life.
That's exactly it.
And for part of her career, she worked at her husband's veterinary clinic.
And when I was paying people, when my husband had his own practice, they would say, "What's that? What's that?" And I'd say, "That's your prepaid medical care for when you are a senior citizen."
We also called up Elaine Shapiro in Brookline, Massachusetts.
I'm 86.
And for most of her life, she was covered under her husband's insurance.
But then when he died, I had cancer and it called for surgery. I didn't have to pay huge medical bills. I was taken care of by Medicare. I've always paid taxes. I think most people feel the way I do. If anyone talks about changing Medicare, we get very nervous.
And some people get more than nervous.
Ours is 35%. Hey, come on, everybody.
You are hearing angry voices here.
You're a liar!
Sounds from a recent town hall meeting in Wisconsin hosted by Congressman Paul Ryan.
If you're yelling, I just want to ask you to leave.
Paul Ryan's the architect of a Republican plan to fundamentally change the way health care for seniors is paid for. His idea would essentially phase Medicare out. In its place, the government would give each person over the age of 65 a voucher worth a certain amount of money that you could then use to buy private health insurance.
The price controls in Medicare today are causing doctors to stop seeing patients, and Medicare is the biggest contributor to skyrocketing health care costs.
The argument Paul Ryan and President Obama both make is that Medicare basically hands a blank check to hospitals and doctors, and critics of Medicare say that system actually encourages wasteful and unnecessary tests and procedures that cost billions of dollars. President Obama argues the government can rein in costs by curbing what it's willing to pay for. Elective surgery, for example. And Paul Ryan says his plan will do the same thing, except put it in the hands of the private sector. Now, whatever you think about either of these ideas, most economists agree on this. Neither will solve Medicare's long-term funding problem, because almost nobody in America, including those seniors we just heard from, has paid for the Medicare benefits they'll receive.
When average couple retiring today has paid just a little over $100,000 in Medicare taxes, and they'll get about $300,000 in benefits.
That's Eugene Sterley. He's a former Treasury Department official, and he decided to look at all the Medicare taxes Americans have paid over the past 50 years. And he found out that the vast majority of people on Medicare today put in less than half of what they'll receive. And he's adjusted for inflation and factored in both employer and employee taxes. And he's not just picking on older folks. For a guy like me, I make out even better. By the time I'm eligible for Medicare in 2039, if the government continues to borrow cash and run massive debts, I'll get about four times the value in benefits than I paid in taxes. So how did we get to the point today where Medicare taxes don't even begin to cover health care costs for seniors? Here's Eugene Sterley.
Well, the way we designed health insurance when health costs were very low is that when you and I went to the doctor, we bargained over what everybody else would pay. So you're the doctor, I'm the patient. We decided need additional MRI. Okay, we send the bill to the taxpayers. You and I decide we need an expensive knee surgery. We send the bill to the taxpayers.
Hip replacement.
Right. And so the incentive for me as a consumer to worry about the cost isn't very high.
There's no incentive.
For the most part. There are some. Over time, there have been gradual increases in copayments, but not very much. But the incentive for providers is also a little strange, too, because the providers have this incentive to keep listing as many services as possible, because the more services the hospital can list, the more they can collect.
Why is it that healthcare costs have risen so dramatically, especially in comparison with inflation?
There are actually three factors involved. We have more and more beneficiaries relative to workers paying into a system. That's driving up the cost of the system and the taxes we have to collect to pay for it. A second one is that we have more and more years of benefits. We're living longer. That's a modest factor over any short period of time, but over decades, it starts adding up quite a bit. The biggest factor in health, which extends far beyond any other system, is that no one really is in charge of saying no to the prices and the services that we're going to receive. And so this medical cost inflation, as it's sometimes described, is out of control under the current system.
So Medicare taxes that people pay, that we all pay out of our paychecks every week or 2 weeks or month, however we're paid, that covers what percentage of Medicare costs?
The Medicare tax per se covers about a third.
A third.
And the premiums the elderly pay maybe cover another sixth.
So the shortfall is made up from other sources of revenue. Money that you could argue could be spent on education or infrastructure or other things.
Well, not just other sources of revenues today. It's also borrowing from China and Germany and a lot of other countries.
So essentially when people say, it's my money, I paid my whole life in payroll taxes, that is a myth. They have been lied to or they have been led to believe something that is just not true.
What they paid for is their parents. They paid for their parents' health care.
I mean,
and if their parents' health care was relatively cheap, that was a good thing. The question then arises, how much can they demand from their children because they paid for their parents? Let's take a simple case. Suppose you have a household with three children and they cover their parents' health costs, and health costs are low. And now the next generation comes along and they only have two children. And they say, well, I paid for my parents. You should pay for me. But now there's fewer children around to pay for it. And in fact, my health costs are a lot higher. So to what extent does that mean that I am entitled from my children to have all my health costs covered?
What you're describing to me sounds, in another context, like a pyramid scheme.
I'm reluctant to use that term, in part because it is possible to have one generation pay for the previous generation and then the next generation to pay for the current one. I mean, in some sense, before we had our elderly programs, that's what we did often as families, right? The question is not whether you want to have a system where children help support their parents, even through a tax system. The question is whether the level of benefits that we're requiring each generation to pay makes sense.
Eugene Sterley, let me just bring in your colleague who worked with you on this research, Stephanie Renan, who is a research associate at the Urban Institute. Stephanie, I don't want you to contradict your boss here, but I know that you did a lot of this research as well. How old are you, by the way?
25.
25. Do you believe that you will receive Medicare?
Well, you know, I mean, when you sit around and if I talk to my friends, other people who are 25 right now, they say, forget it, it's not going to be around for us. I think the system probably will be retained in some way, probably won't look like what it does today.
Were you surprised to see how little, in comparison to what you receive, how little people pay in taxes over the course of their careers and then what they actually receive? Did that surprise you?
Yeah, it surprised me initially. I mean, when you think about it, it makes sense, but it's not what you kind of assume when you think about the system, you know, from an outside perspective.
Eugene Sterley, let me ask you this. A lot of people who listen to this program are beneficiaries, Medicare beneficiaries. So forgive me if this is going to anger you, but I want to ask, Eugene, I want to ask you this question. In order to make this system solvent, will people currently on Medicare and people about to receive Medicare, will they have to also make sacrifices?
I don't see any way we can exempt any broad portion of the population from tackling our broad budget issues.
And when you say tackling those issues, you're talking about?
I'm talking about everything. I'm talking about higher taxes. I'm talking about possible cuts. But let me be clear, and this is very misleading. When we're talking about cuts in things like health care and even elderly support programs, we're basically talking about cuts in a rate of growth. So if healthcare is going to grow by $100 billion next year and we only let it grow by $80 billion, we don't say that's an increase of $80 billion. We define that as a $20 billion cut. Mm. What we have to do to get this budget under control is to bring health costs and to some extent retirement programs down to a rate of growth that's sustainable. But it doesn't mean, for instance, that your children aren't going to get more healthcare in the future. They are, partly because we're going to invent a lot better things to provide them. It just means the rate of growth that we now promise is totally unsustainable.
That's Eugene Sterley. He's a former Treasury Department official and now a fellow at the Urban Institute. You can find all of his research at the website urban.org. Eugene Sterley, thanks so much.
Sorry, very much. Thank you.
And Stephanie Renan, thank you.
Thanks.
Now, the U.S. is unlikely to intervene in Syria, as it has in Libya. And retired Colonel Douglas MacGregor thinks that's a good thing, and not because he opposes democracy, but rather because all these foreign interventions, he says, are too expensive. Now, you've heard it before 1,000 times. The U.S. spends more on defense than the rest of the world combined. Just last year, almost a third of all tax dollars the federal government collected went to the Pentagon. So amid the anxiety over the national debt, Douglas MacGregor argues that the military will also have to make sacrifices. He says over 3 years, you could cut the Pentagon's budget by 40%. And he's laid out that plan in the latest issue of Foreign Policy magazine, where he writes that a leaner military wouldn't just be more cost-effective, but also a better fit for America's security interests.
We have this phrase, and I'm sure all of your listeners have heard it, war of choice, the emphasis on choice. If you look at all of the interventions that we have launched since 1945, beginning with Vietnam in 1965 and moving forward, none of them have changed the international system at all. And none of them have directly benefited us strategically. The last military event that had a true strategic impact on the international system was the Second World War. So Americans need to understand that these wars of choice, these interventions of choice, have been both unnecessary, counterproductive, strategically self-defeating, and infinitely too expensive for what we can actually afford.
What happens? I mean, you're essentially saying you've got to starve the beast here.
Yes.
You've got to turn off the taps.
Yes.
So in 3 years' time, a 40% reduction, you're saying the Pentagon is just going to have to adapt to that, and it's going to force them to do
yes.
it.
All positive military change. If you look at the Soviet state, if you look at Nazi Germany, if you go back before the First World War and look at the Royal Navy and the British Army, the various military formations over the 19th and 20th centuries, what you discover is that the most innovation and the most positive change and adaptation to reality occurs not in a flood of money, but in its absence. That's when people have to sit down and come to terms with reality and realize that they cannot go on into the future and do what they've done in the past.
Okay, the U.S. is expected to spend about $700 billion on defense this year. You're saying immediately you can cut about $300 billion out of that. Where would you actually cut the money?
Well, first of all, you have a very bloated force structure. We have over 1,500 flag officers. We have
talking about generals and
generals
admirals.
And admirals, that's right. And we have enormous numbers of single service headquarters, and we have multiple regional unified commands. These are the combatant commands that emerged in the 1980s, largely in response to a Soviet empire that was already on the decline. We don't need all of those headquarters. We don't need all of those commands. And they cost billions of dollars. No one has come forward and admitted that for the last 10 years, I would argue certainly since 1991, we have faced the weakest adversaries that we have ever encountered in the history of this country. Now, what do I mean by that? You're talking about people with no armies, no air forces, no air defenses, no naval capability. You come to terms with the reality that the nature of warfare has changed, that technology, new technologies, new organizations, new force structures, new force designs allow you to do things differently and more cheaply.
But in virtually every congressional district, there is some component built or created that is for the defense industry. It employs many, many, many thousands of people all across this country. So realistically, how do you think that your plan would ever be implemented?
Well, I think the plan can be implemented when people come to terms with an understanding that we have to deliver the services that were promised under Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Mm-hmm. We cannot honor those obligations and do so without reducing defense and reorienting our defense posture to a world that's very different today from the one in which most of these forces were created and invented. And what we have right now are very powerful military bureaucracies tied to the defense industries that want to stay in business that are, quite frankly, larger than we need. And we have congressional interests that want to sustain prosperity at home and see the military budget as a way to cultivate prosperity by redistributing income. This is an enormous problem, but we've got to deal with it because we can't afford it, and it will ultimately consume us over time.
That's Douglas McGregor. He's a retired U.S. Army colonel. He recently wrote about this subject for Foreign Policy magazine. The article is called Lean, Mean Fighting Machine. His latest book is called Warrior's Rage. Douglas McGregor, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
In the mid-1990s, comedy writer Phil Rosenthal scored a huge hit with his sitcom, Everybody Loves Raymond.
Hi, I'm Ray, and I live here in Long Island with my wife, Deborah.
It's very likely you have seen the show. It was about the Barone family and the small annoyances that we all encounter in daily life, leaving clothes on the floor or drinking from the milk carton, that kind of stuff. And 33 million viewers tuned in to watch the finale in 2005. Now, after the series ended, it found a second life in syndication, but it also got the attention of the Russians. They wanted to turn Everybody Loves Raymond into Everybody Loves Костя.
Костя, спортивный журналист.
Смотреть хоккей, футбол, еще за это деньги получать.
But would it work? Now, the sitcom format is still relatively new to Russian television, and so American networks have been pushing to bring them to the Russian market. And that's what happened to Phil Rosenthal in 2009.
The head of Sony called me in his office a few years ago, and he told me that Sony created the sitcom in Russia.
There was no All in the Family or no. Cosby Show. There's nothing like that.
Nothing like that.
It did not exist in Russia.
No. Until Sony brought The Nanny, the show The Nanny, over there and translated their episodes into Russian, cast Russian actors and put it on Russian TV, and it became a huge hit.
So The Nanny was groundbreaking historic television in Russia.
Yes, the first ever sitcom.
So the head of Sony said to you, we think this can work with Everybody Loves Raymond. Let's give it a shot. That's basically what he said?
Actually, what he said was, how would you like to go over there and observe how we work with the Russians, come back and write a fictional feature film about a showrunner who goes over there to have his show translated? And I said, oh, well, that sounds good, but if the situation exists and the people you're telling me about really exist, why not bring a camera crew over and film what would really happen? And he said, I love that idea. Would you be the guy? And I said, yeah, I want to make that movie. And he goes, no, make your movie, but be the guy in the movie. Go do your show over there.
So you go to Russia, yep. And you're thinking, this is a no-brainer, simple premise. It's a family comedy. This is universal stuff, right? And you could actually make this happen. You could make Everybody Loves Raymond in Russia. But then you get to Russia, and what do you find out?
They have other plans. I didn't think it would be a slam dunk, but I was led to believe that we could have something universal in the premise of our show because it is so simple. It's just about a family.
And it takes place in a house.
It takes place in a house. The wife and the husband, the parents bother you, the kids sometimes. So why wouldn't it be? I mean, we're in 148 countries, our version, dubbed or subtitled. We still get letters from Sri Lanka. That's my mother. When I got to Russia, they said to me, real life is terrible. Why would we put that on television?
They said, no one thinks that real life is funny.
That's right.
So I mean, was the nanny, wasn't that rooted in some reality at all?
Have you seen it?
No, the Russian version, no.
Have you seen the American version?
A couple times, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So that's not, by definition, rooted in reality. It was a fantasy show. It was a broad, cartoony type of show on purpose. Nothing wrong with it. It's just that our show was about the minutiae of daily life and the petty family squabbles that we all have and how we take the little things in life and blow them up to become big things. They didn't think that this would play with their audience.
Not only that, they didn't think it was funny.
Well, yeah. When I would see them rehearsing their way of doing it, which was to make it much broader, I didn't see them laughing either, which gave me reason to say, why don't you try it, you know, in a realistic, naturalistic way? Which, by the way, is the tradition of the Russians, if you look at theater, which comes from there, Stanislavski, Chekhov, right? It's their tradition. But when it comes to sitcoms and what the executives think the audience out there will like, the rules are different somehow.
For example, one of the staffers, the costume designer, she wanted to dress these characters, ostensibly a middle-class family. She wanted to dress them in designer clothing at home.
Yes.
You were trying to explain to her that this was simply unrealistic. But she pushed back. She said, no, the show should have some flair, a sense of style.
Yes, and I'm saying, look at this character right now in front of us. She's wearing a cashmere sweater, fancy pants, high heels, jewelry. I said, you understand she's cleaning the house, right? And she says, yes, but she's on television. And I said, yes, but she doesn't know she's on television. She thinks she's cleaning.
So what makes Raymond appealing and funny to American audiences, at least, is that he's kind of this bumbling guy, kind of a pushover at times. But that was actually a big challenge in Russia because they thought he was this loser who wasn't funny at all.
I was told that the Russian men are way more macho than American men.
Right.
And no way does the wife, rule the house. And I thought, just listening to this, that this was baloney. That you can have this outer shell of macho and this is what you want to present to the world and this is what you want to present even to, you know, yourselves. But I just don't believe it. I think you could be the most macho guy in the world and as soon as you get in the house, the wife is telling you to pick up your socks.
When you started casting for the roles, you had the Russian actors adapt a particular scene. I'm going to play it in the original English. And so this is from Everybody Loves Raymond. This is the scene about the Fruit of the Month Club.
Your birthday gift to me finally came this morning. And did you know you sent me a box of pears?
Yeah, yeah.
From a place called Fruit of the Month?
That's right, that's right. How are they?
Oh, they're very nice pears. But there's so many of them. There are over a dozen pears. What am I supposed to do with all those pears?
Well, I think you're supposed to eat them.
Myself?
You and Dad and Robert.
How many pears can Robert eat? Look, I appreciate the thought, Raymond, but please don't ever send us any more food again, okay? Thanks.
Well, another box is coming next month.
What? More pears?
No, it's a different fruit every month.
Every month?
Yes, yes, that's why they call it Fruit of the Month Club.
It's a club? Oh my God, what am I going to do with all this fruit?
Okay, now there is no Fruit of the Month Club in Russia, so what do the Russians do with this scene?
They changed it to Water of the Week.
And does that exist in Russia, Water of the Week?
No, that doesn't exist either. But for some reason, that was going to be more relatable to them, which is fine with me. I just happen to think this is a personal, subjective opinion that fruit is funnier than water.
So do they consult with you, the writers who are working on Everybody Loves Kostya? Do they contact
No.
you? No, that's it. It's you're done.
I like to think I had a great influence on them. And that they saw things my way. And what I think happened was they said, oh, you're very smart. Thank you for coming. Goodbye. And then did whatever the hell they wanted.
I know the show is in countries around the world. And I've heard that you may be bringing it to Israel and to Poland next. Is that true?
Poland did call.
They
do want the show. I'm not going.
You're not going to get involved.
I get the whole Eastern European thing now. I've done it. That's it.
Israel,
I visited Israel once. I found it to be a lot like Hebrew school.
So you're not getting involved either?
No. I there's a terrific guy over there who's going to adapt the show, who's a big sitcom hero over there in Israel where they do have sitcoms. Mm. So he has my blessing. Go ahead. By the way, I'm here if they want to call me and ask for anything, but I don't think they need to, and I don't think I should expect them to. I learned that it's for them. They have to do it their way, and I have to let go. I have to be a big boy.
That's writer-director Phil Rosenthal. His documentary is called Exporting Raymond. It's out in theaters now, and it's about his journey to adapt his hit TV show Everybody Loves Raymond for a Russian audience. Phil Rosenthal, thank you so much.
A great pleasure. Thank you.
For the early MTV generation, there are few artists more iconic than Rick Ocasek, the frontman for the Cars. Pencil thin, that shock of black hair, the dark sunglasses, the cigarette dangling from his lip. Rick Ocasek was new wave rock and roll. And if the good times stopped rolling for you around the time the Cars split up in the late 1980s, well, I have some good news for you. Those times, they're back. This is the first track off the Cars' first album in 24 years. It's out this month. The record's called Move Like This. You believe in anything, they tell you how to think. A simpleton's a circle in the raging roller rink. A trading in the alley, we'll buckle up a storm. Forget about reality, cause nothing is a norm. Now, not too long ago, Rick Ocasek said, a Cars reunion? Forget about it. Put it out of your mind. Well, thankfully, something or someone convinced him that millions of us needed them back. And Rick Ocasek, I have to say, as a professional journalist, I'm not supposed to get giddy and starstruck, but I am so excited to have you on this afternoon. And thanks for being here. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
This is a Cars record. It's unmistakable. It's almost as if you picked up where you left off, with updates, modern updates, contemporary updates. What made you change your mind about bringing the group back together?
It was really just the songs that I wrote, and I thought, well, who could play these the best? How could I make it easy for myself? So I thought I'll call the guys and see if they want to make another record.
As I mentioned, this record, I think it's almost like a gift to your fans. I mean, they will recognize the sound and the style and the sensibility. Tell me about what you wanted the record to sound like when you were sort of thinking about it.
That's a good question. I don't know what I thought it should sound like. I just knew that when I got the members of the band back that it would take on that car sound. I think that comes from each individual, you know, and their personal talents. And when they put themselves into it, it ends up just sounding like the Cars.
Is it strange to you? I mean, you've been out of the Cars for almost a quarter century. You're older and wiser, and does it just feel natural, or is it a little bit weird to go back?
It didn't feel unnatural. No, it felt kind of like maybe we were together. We just finished a record a month before. It really ended up, you know, people came into the rehearsal and really within 10 minutes it was like, oh yeah, this is the way it should be, because it really just comes from the people that are and their talents, you know, their individual talents. So I couldn't imagine why it would have changed. If I would have taken any number of songs or maybe any of the ones I did on my own records and just did them as, with the Cars, it would have sounded like a Cars record.
It almost sounds like you never really wanted to be in the spotlight. It kind of was foisted on you, and yet you're sort of the most identifiable front man for the Cars.
That's because I look like Ichabod Crane.
But it's almost as if you're kind of, and maybe even still reluctant to kind of play that role.
Yeah, I'm not into that much into being the front guy. I was the songwriter, really, and the person who put the songs together and maybe a bit of a director. But being an entertainer was never my, you know, main thing.
How do you do it when you go on stage? I mean, you're about to go on tour and you're going to play in front of thousands of people and mm-hmm. they're going to be looking forward to seeing you up there. Do you How do you do that? Do you have to kind of turn into that person, that stage person, for those 2 or 3 hours?
No, that's what I don't do. Hmm. You see, I don't like being an entertainer. I play the songs from the heart. I probably won't do any kind of fake moves, or I probably won't prod the masses to react. I'll probably just perform the songs.
I'm speaking with Rick Ocasek. He's the frontman for The Cars. Their new album is called Move Like This. There's a track on this record, this new record. It's a slower song, almost, I would say, a tender song. It's called Soon.
That song really is kind of about time running out. I think it kind of says that everything's cool, but, you know, time's going to run away without our permission pretty soon. So it's kind of like more of a little heartbreaker than it is a little song.
Right.
But soon, the time will come. I know what I put you.
Your collaborator in The Cars, Benjamin Orr, he died in 2000, and he was probably, I guess, best known for singing lead vocals on the song Drive.
You can't go on thinking nothing's wrong. What about who's gonna drive you home tonight?
I know that Benjamin Orr was a really close friend of yours.
Yes.
Going way back.
Oh, yeah.
Were you reluctant to do this without him?
It was a good reason, you know, not to. I certainly didn't want to replace him. That's why we didn't. We just kept the four of us. It was one reason. It wasn't the main reason, but it made it harder to think about. But, well, we went through with it anyway.
You famously said that The Cars will never reunite, obviously. Thankfully, you have. Is this the last Cars record, or will there be another one, maybe?
Yeah, there could be another one. You know, we have fun doing this one, and I'm not going to say... whatever I say, I can manipulate, I can contradict it, so... I said I'd never do it, and I did it, so... if I say I'll do it again, then I'll probably never do it.
That's Rick Ocasek. He's the frontman for the band The Cars. Their new album out this month is called Move Like This. Rick, it's been great catching up and having you on. Thanks for doing this record for all your fans.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this podcast edition of The Best of Weekends and All Things Considered. The program this weekend was directed by Brent Bachman and produced by Phil Harrell, Petra Mayer, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Megan Kane, and Jessica Deal. Daniel Shukin is our technical director. Rick Holter is our senior editor, and our senior producer is Matt Martinez. I'm Guy Raz. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. It's on in most places between 5 and 6 p.m. on Saturdays and Sundays.